Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to be talking about a subject matter that, well, I think it's extremely important. And it is important because it represents the quality of character that one man has exhibited with a business and actually with the way he's lived his life, that I think all of us need to be aware of, because too often we buy in to the adage, good guys always finish last. And that's not the case. My guest today is Bob Moore. He is the founder of Bob Red Mill. A book has been written by Ken Koopman called People Before Profit. How does that sound to you? Well, if you study history, you'll find that all too many times in business, that was not the case. It was profit before people. We're going to be talking with Bob Moore and finding out why and for what reasons he adopted a stance that is not necessarily taught in business schools. I want to welcome to the airwaves Bob Moore. Bob, thank you for taking time out of your most interesting and productive life to share some time with us.
Thank you for asking me, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Now, you are a man that has walked a very interesting route with business. You have the heart of an entrepreneur. Bob, your plant, Bob's Red Mill, is in Oregon. What really started you on the path of entrepreneurship? If you could sort of narrow it down, what made you decide that this was what you really wanted to be involved with?
I don't think I've really ever had any other choice in my mind, Donna. My father was an entrepreneur. My grandfather was. Both sides of the family, we had yeast factories and companies that produced printing and advertising brochures. It's just that I've been surrounded with business all my life. And the one piece that impressed me the most through my life was my father, who just didn't do anything but business. And that's all we talked about. And, oh, that's not all we talked about, but we did a lot of talking about what we might be able to do together, he and his son, that was me, what we could do together when I was older and had served. I had 3 years in the Army. And so, really, I can't hardly remember a time when being in business wasn't what somehow, some way, I was going to do.
Now, so many young people that are graduating from college, many of them want to go into an entrepreneurial environment. They see it as the great adventure. But you learned early on that what you aspire to and what you desire to do doesn't necessarily work out the way you expect. What kind of wisdom would you want to share with a young person today?
I think that a failure, if you've really given it all you have, I mean, I'm not speaking of just being foolish and running out and seeing how much money you can throw away, but if you made a genuine effort and circumstances, whether they, in my case, happen to be weather or other things, don't just weather the storm. I've actually lost everything, started over twice in my life, and each time, there are so many lessons. I wouldn't want to advocate somebody just go out and try something and then purposely fail at it so they can learn what it feels like, how your stomach feels when you look in the checkbook and you don't have enough money to pay the bills for, in my case, gasoline or tires. You've simply run out of money. That's a terrible feeling, and I've had little senses of that. Even in this business, back many years ago after my fire, I did not go broke then, but still we dipped down and had some difficult moments, and immediately that same feeling of what it it's coming. Be careful. Use every method and source you can, because I didn't want to fail at this one. I had already had my experience of running out of money and having to start all over again. So if I had the advice that you asked me to give, would be that if you do fail at something, give it everything you have, but be ready to pick up, look at what how you could correct it, what mistakes you made. I think it's very important to look at oneself. The tendency today with our school system and everywhere I look is to blame somebody for everything. This is not a kind of a situation where you want to blame anyone. You want to look at yourself. What could I do? How could I be better? What decisions did I make? Was I just foolish? All these kind of things, they need to be very introspective. And I think perhaps being that way, especially in a startup business, would be some excellent advice for young people or even old people who want to start over.
Well, and I think that that's wisdom, that we need to know that things can happen just like it did with your business. Now, you have a very special lady in your life, your wife,
yes,
who actually
Charlotte.
Was the inspiration for you to get into an environment that actually brought your company, Bob's Red Mill, to life. Tell us how that evolved, because she's quite a gal, and I know that in the book, People Before Profits, it's just a wonderful story about the two of you, but tell us about this wonderful lady in your life.
Well, Charlie, Charlee, and anybody who writes about this, be sure and spell her name right, or she'll come back and haunt you. She likes spelling. They're always spelling it I-E or E-Y or something. But anyway, I met her working at U.S. Electrical Motors. At the time, I was on nights, and I was going to school on the GI Bill during the day. And I didn't have a whole lot of time for courtship, but, well, obviously I found time, didn't I? And so we got married about a year later, and, you know, we have three boys. And Charlie's always taken life very serious. And the responsibility of having three children pretty quickly and living with me my crazy ways, her grandmother gave her several books on health by Adele Davis, Gaylord Houser, and at the time in the 1950s was Rodell, who started Prevention Magazine, which is still in existence. And these magazines and books spelled out what they thought, at least, was a better diet, whole grains and vegetables and fruits and a lot of other things that were coming to the fore, chemicals and different things. And so, being a very serious person, she decided that it would be good if that's what we ate in our household. And so I got used to this pretty early, Donna, looking at wonderful whole grain breads coming out of the oven. And I was not hard to convince that this was really the best way to go. And in fact, I've read these books myself, not right away. It took a while. But I listened to her. We all were raised by Charlie, the three boys. and I think health-wise and whatnot, we are all doing quite well because of her. And because of her grandmother's books that she took serious. A little story about her grandmother. I was a smoker, of course, being in the service. You know, you have to smoke to be in the service.
Well,
anyway,
that's what I understand.
I don't know how she put up with me, but I can remember going to her grandmother's house with her and the kids and stuff and going in, and her grandmother took me on for smoking and for not paying any attention to some of the things that she was saying to us. And I was so disgusted with her. I told Charlie, I said, listen, I'm just going to go out in the car and have a cigarette, and I'll just wait for you while you visit with your grandmother. And, you know, honestly, Donna, I would love to be able to apologize to her because I was really a big fool. And yes, I did quit smoking. I haven't smoked for 50 years, but anyway, at that time, it was a pretty big deal.
Now, but Bob, you mentioned you had been in the service. Now, when you were in the military, there was some training that you got that was extremely valuable to you. You ended up working in a financial office, didn't you? And you were responsible for a lot of things. That really was even, in many respects, more useful to you than taking classes at a college. I mean, you really were down there in the basics, working with a lot of detail.
Well, when you joined the Army, they gave you what your elections were. If you waited to be drafted, you more or less did what they did. And my father was always advising me on the right thing to do. And, of course, he was very serious, too. And I was given all these this advice about taking my job seriously and everything. And I was put into the finance office. And I can remember for a long time being, they had to have an enlisted man count the money for payday. And we gave, at that time, the Army paid in cash. You had a little, they just counted it out to you. And I can still remember the lines of all the guys standing in line in the lunchroom, day room. And there were three of us there. It was me. I was the low end. I started, I counted the money. And then my first sergeant counted it, and then my captain counted it. So that's how it was. So you can't make a mistake. I'm serious. You can't make a mistake. I don't know what they did do. But I was in the finance and fiscal office. I eventually transferred in and became in my company. I became the company clerk and did all the filing, daily sheets, and I got pretty good at writing letters, and I got a pretty good education out of the whole thing. It wasn't bad. And then as an extra sideline, the officers club needed someone to keep the books over there, and I didn't even realize it at the time, but all my hours at the officers club, which were on my own time, I was paid extra for that. And I got a check from Special Services each month for my time at the officers club. So all in all, I guess I sort of took things serious, and yes, there was an element about serving, and there was an element about learning, and there was an element about making extra money. But all in all, I did not mind the military at all. It was in 1947 to 1950. So it was the only period of time I can recall when we weren't in a war. We just over World War II, and Korea started in June of 1950, and I got out just before that. So I had this military time that was very educational. And because of this 3 years in the Army, I got two things that were very important to me. I used the 3 years in electronics and whatnot while I was working with U.S. Electrical Motors, and I also, of course, got a GI house, which was something that Charlie and I fortunately had a chance to start with. So all in all, it helped me a great deal.
Now, you have, or there are pictures of you and the wonderful flour mill, your Morris flour mill that started in Redding, California. You came across a book. It was in 1968 when you were at the Redding Public Library, and it was called John Goff's Mill. And Ken, in your book, People Before Profits, said that this was a book that really changed your life. Why?
Oh, my goodness. Remember now, Charlie was feeding us whole grains, and I always had a real respect for it. And we were peopling the little health food store, or actually there was more than one, there were two, but that had bulk bins, and in the bulk bins they had millet and whole wheat flour and all these different things. And that's kind of what she was feeding us, or at least a portion of it. And So when I saw John Goffey's mill, I have it in my hand, Donna. I have I got on the website and found a copy of it, and I have it with me now and have kept it on my desk as a reminder of how I started. And on the outside of the book, it has pictures of his mill and the water wheel and the mills and stuff. And it was such a wonderful revelation to me to see this fellow who was an archaeologist and a renowned one at the time. He had done major digs in Mesopotamia and Egypt. So he was kind of high on his education, but totally unqualified to restore a mill and then to get the business going. And that's what impressed me. He inherited, I had never inherited anything, but he inherited this flour mill that was part of his family. That's where the Goff is. George Woodbury's mother's name was Goff, so he was just in the same generation. And he wrote this charming book, about how he restored this mill. And the two things I got out of it, first, he didn't know what he was doing. I mean, mm-hmm. he took on something that he was not particularly qualified for, but he was qualified for other things. And people, the public, beat a path to his door to buy his stone ground cornmeal and whole wheat flour. And those are the two things that when I tied together these books by Del Davis and Rodell and different ones about how we should eat and whole grains, I thought, well, of course, if George Woodbury can do this with no more training than he's had, then I should be able to too. And that was Donna. That was truly the turning point in my life. I don't know what advice I could give. Maybe watch out for strange books in libraries, but you never know what's going to impress you. But you said the story exactly right. And I've never forgotten, I guess, my roots or something, because I've sat here waiting for a meeting or waiting for the phone to ring or something as I'm doing now and read a chapter in that book, and I get as much out of it today. It's just as inspirational to me as it was the first time I read it in early 1960s, early now, to mid-1960s.
In 73 and 74, there was the setting up of the mill operation.
Right.
And I was amazed to find that there was, I mean, you used anything you possibly could. You didn't have a lot of money to work with. So
nope.
You just scrounged. But why is the mill wheel so significant? And is that quartz? I mean, this is something that was educational for me. With your food products, with your grains, there's a specific technique that you use so that the nutrition is retained in the food products that are processed. What was it about the mill wheel that had to be specifically understood, and how did it operate? Why was it so important that mill wheel be just the quality of type of what that it was?
Well, I think you can grind grain with anything, and sometimes when there'd be a startup in a community back in the 1700s and 1800s, a miller could pretty much use anything, but they don't stay sharp, and they're just not right. But over the centuries and millennia, it was discovered that in near Paris, France, La Ferté, there was an outcropping of stone that even the Romans, this would be, 2,500 years ago, discovered that this particular outcropping of stone was very hard. It's a volcanic origin, and it's porous in the sense that no matter how it wears, there's always surfaces that will grind the grain. Now, keep in mind that we never allow the stones to touch. So we're not grinding stone. We're grinding grain in between it.
Mm-hmm.
So that the right combination of things, the speed of the stone, which is the top stone about 100 revolutions per minute, and and the stone itself and the way it's sharpened. I have a book that is it's called The Millwright's Journal. I'm looking at it because I've brought all my books down, and Nancy's getting a hold of it right now, and it has tips. It goes back for many years, and that's the one nice thing about early day business. Everything wasn't a secret. The millers would bring people in and show them how they sharpened the stone. This knowledge was passed on. There wasn't a great secret about everything. And so because of that, I've availed myself of various books and even John Gough's mill helps to show the configuration. And this one book has nothing but pictures of how millstones are sharpened to do various things. It's a charming book, reprint of, where is that one, Nance? There it is, right? That's great, thanks. It's called The Versatile Millstone Workhorse of Many Industries. And, of course, I was just interested in the grinding of flour, but this is a case where research and learning what's how to make it go was very important. I'm not too sure that I could have been successful if I hadn't have had a few of these old books. Some were with print reprints of 17 and 1800s, because you have to depend on other people's experience and skills and stuff. And in every case, old millers were more than willing to share what they had learned and how their stones work when they did certain things to it. So the configuration and the stone itself are very, very important to the success of this. But there was one other thing that was sort of philosophical, and that is my determination to see if I could make a living, a real, true living, using equipment that was about 125 years old. And that thrilled me. It just I was caught up in it. And the grain cleaning equipment, things that you have to have, the screens and the blowers and things in order to clean the grain as it comes from the field, all of those things are very ancient in their past. And so I was able through finding old mills that were still not torn down or burned up, to find some equipment. And at one point, the early point, really all the equipment we had, I could walk people around and show them that, you know, this was 1870, this is 1872. We have, I think that's about the earliest. A lot of it was the 1880s and whatnot. But that isn't the case now, Donna. We discovered about 15 years ago that there's a company in Denmark called Skjold. They're in Saby, Denmark, and I had a mutual friend that told me about it. I went over there and visited them, and here, lo and behold, these people are making wonderful stone mills, and they are, because they're on the mainland of Europe, they simply send trucks down to the same quarry that the Romans were using 2,500 years ago, to the same quarry, and they bring back stone, and with that stone, they configure millstones so that, and then they make new millstones. And I have over 20 of those running in my plant right now. So,
I've
taken this ancient skill and art, and with the help of others, I must say, and books and the writings of previous millers, and used it all to make the company what it is today.
Well, your information about all of these processes that go back centuries that really work so that you can get the best nutrition out of the grains. In the book, you talk about the thumb of gold, the miller's thumb, the importance of building relationships with suppliers. There, one of your supplier was Gusto's Vita Grain, a family that had started their business in 1940, and by by the 70s, when you started yours, they were a major processor and wholesaler, just about of every grain and baking ingredient that any home would use. And you really got into this, and it was so important that the vision be expanded. Now, you're known for making lists and putting things down on a piece of paper, and it's a habit you acquired, I think, many, many, many years ago. And then you and your son went into developing the mill in California, and then eventually the two of you decided you were each going to go your own direction. And how did you find your location in Oregon? I'm always intrigued with it, because you chose Oregon, and how in the world did you figure out where you were going to put your Bob's Red Mill?
Well, you're skipping a part, Donna. Actually, it was two of my three sons that we were working together with in Redding, and we had a successful business. Bob is still in that down there, son Bob, middle son. So, but what we discovered is that Redding was about 16, 17,000 people, and we had three households. By this time, the boys were having children, and this thing wasn't going to sustain itself in a small town in this unusual business. It has, however, done Bob very well, and he's branched out into other equipment, making corn grits and granolas and stuff for us. So we've managed to survive that low point in the business's life, and I thought it would be an excellent opportunity for me to go back to seminary in Redding, or in Portland, which is where I am now, to learn to read the Bible in the original languages, Hebrew and Greek. And that was the purpose and point of coming to Portland. They had four different seminaries up here, and they all had something to offer to me. And one Western Evangelical took Charlie and me and made it possible for us to edit or to audit courses in New Testament Greek. So we sold our worldly goods. Now, my wife's a very frugal lady, and we made, at the time when we sold our home in Redding, I still can't even to this day believe how much money we got for it compared to what we paid for it. That was in that very inflationary period of time when we couldn't believe what how much money we were worth. And then I had been 10 years with the JCPenney company. I managed the auto center there in Redding. So all in all, we had enough resources to give the mill to the boys, or actually to Bob, and then to move to Portland, Oregon. Very humble now. We had a nice apartment just a couple of blocks from the seminary, and we enrolled in Western Evangelical Seminary to try and learn to read the Bible in the original languages. So that's how I got here. Now, from there on, when you're trying to learn a language, it requires a lot of time. And one of the things it required of us was a lot of walking time. We would put verbs and nouns on a little 3x5 cards, and then we would walk the neighborhood for miles and miles. It was very nice, actually. Having worked all my life, I had this short period of time where we simply walked and talked and read, tried to figure out verbs and things and teach each other as we went. And one day, after a few months of being here, we walked down a certain street, and there was a flour mill. I can still remember to this day, it was derelict, it looked pretty poor, and had a for sale sign on the property. And of course, having been in the business, I was astounded that here was an old mill. I told Charlie, I said, "Hun, that is an old mill." And I had to walk up and look in the door, and inside I could see bucket elevators, grain cleaners, the type of equipment that was necessary to do what I do. And it was on an old rail line, and they had pulled the rail line out in 1957. So the building was just not being used. It was all there was some church groups that were using it for bazaars, and it was full of boxes of clothes and all that kind of stuff. But basically, the fellow that had recently bought it was going to tear it down. So, you know, there's some challenges in life. Was I going to let this old mill get torn down? I don't know. My poor wife, I can remember her saying, "Well, hon, I thought we were going to go to school." And I said, oh, we are, we are. I can still remember saying that. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. But I'm just going to make a phone call and see what they're going to do with this thing. And I know it's crazy. It's like picking up the book, John Goffey's Mill. Instead of picking up a book, I picked up a mill. So the transition was I talked to the owner, and he said he laughed about it and thought I was really crazy to start this thing over. But, you know, he let me do it. He gave me a lease with an option to buy the property. We opened the mill in 3 months from the time we saw it. And, Donna, I don't know how to describe success except that to say that this crazy mill was a real success. I hadn't been open more than a couple of weeks when in walks Kathy Smith, who at that time was the leader here in the Portland area in the TV news. And she had a cameraman with her, and she did this delightful little scene with me and asking questions. And that night or the next night, we were on the evening news for about 5 minutes. And it was just astounding. Portland, with a million people as a base for population in the area, was so different than we had in Reading, where we had, you know, 15 or 16,000 people. And it really just kind of blew me away. And I guess,
Bob,
you're talking
I want
to the...
Okay, I'm going to stop you here. We're going to take a break for a minute. Will you stay with me for a little bit longer?
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful.
No, I'll stay with you. Yeah.
All right.
Thank
Bob
you.
Moore, the man who built a phenomenal food processing company, Bob's Red Mill. You'll see it in your grocery stores. You'll see it in your health food stores. We're going to continue to tell his story when we come back, because everything was rosy, and then something happened that could have destroyed it all. We'll find out what that is in just a moment. Donna Siebel here. We'll be right back.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you. We offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Siebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. We're continuing our chat with Bob Moore, who founded the company Bob's Red Mill. Now, Bob Moore is a man who not only had an idea, is an entrepreneur at heart, but he also was right in the throes of whatever needed to be done. And with his company that he started, and this was in Portland, Oregon. Now, remember, he had already had quite a background behind him. But when he started this, he had a wonderful opportunity. The business grew, and then something happened that could have absolutely destroyed everything. Bob, what was that?
Oh, dear. Well, I got a call about 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the night from the local fire dispatcher, who was the sister of one of the people who worked for me. She said, Bob, we have a fire alarm for the mill. Perhaps you should get down there and see what's going on. Well, we only lived 1 mile, and as soon as I got in the car and started down the street, I could see the glow towards the mill, and as I came around a certain corner, there it was. Flames were shooting up into the sky, and the fire trucks, of course, with their flashing lights, were occupying the whole area. And I'm not sure just how I felt. I felt that I needed to get down there, but I also felt that because it was an old mill, it was very old, the wood was very dry. And I really felt this was going to be a tough one to get through. You just knew right away that it was going to be, you were in for a trial. Sure enough, we got down there, and of course, the fire people let me get through the blocked road and get over to the fire marshal and whatnot, and they were so sympathetic. We had 7 fire companies down there. In fact, the street was just crowded with trucks, and everybody knew us, and we'd been there 10 years, and we were part of the community, and it was something else. And Charlie came down in her own car. I asked her, you know, I told her when I left, I said, oh, hon, don't come down. But she did. And but, you know, no matter how hard they tried, that old building just burned up. It was pretty big. It was about 18,000 square feet, 3 stories. So wow. It was a lot of stuff to burn. And the fire, they were so good to me. I have such a warm feeling for the fire department, not just because of this, but because of the other help that they've given me to make my place safe and things. They've always worked with me. It's the community has always been a warm place for me. But he said, well, we have so many fire trucks here and so much water. The mill was, of course, down in a low area where there was plenty of water pressure. And he said, we could try to save some area. And I said, oh, for goodness sake, try to save the mill area. So they got a fireman over there to cut a hole in the side of the building and went into the mill room. And then a couple of firemen sat there on the ground with a powerful fire hose, pouring water into the mill room through this large hole that they cut in the side of the building. And they did the same thing in the office area towards the back of the mill. So I know it sounds crazy, but here's this building that's literally burned to the ground practically. But the mills, we saved them. There were 3 wonderful stone mills that we were using every day, and we had to replace the wood on them, but the stones were fine. We were able, of course, except for the water, but we were able to save our records and different things that were important to the function of the company. We did have a safe, and so that we did have the checkbook and things like that in the safe. But due to the wonderful conscientiousness and help of the local fire department, we were able to save the elements of the business that allowed us to continue on. Now, I was just about 60 at the time. But here's a thought I'd like to convey to you. I had an employee who came to work for me almost 10 years before this, Dave Guider, and we had been through Dave's early life. He was about 19, and his courtship and his wedding and the first child And they, of course, were all friends with the firemen and everything. And so there were quite a few of us down there in the parking lot, all concerned and worried and talking with one another. And Eileen, his wife, said, well, Bob, you know, this is crazy. We signed the papers on a home today. And, you know, I guess Dave won't have a job. Just thought you, you know, kind of let me know. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I can make this thing work. There were three things that made this work. Number one, of course, was Eileen coming up to me and telling me in a way, in a kind of a backwards way, how important it was that I continue this on. Dave's still with me today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We celebrated his, what, 53rd birthday? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he came to work when he was 19. You can figure that one out.
That's right. That's
Dave
right.
Dave is fully in charge of all the milling in our operation. He's just a wonderful person. I don't know. He probably has 30 or 40 people under him. And I'm so glad I did this, Donna. And then the other one was I got my insurance. We had insurance on the building and stuff. And it was about $150,000 or $160,000. That's not very much, but it was more in 1988 than it would be now. And I got that check within about 3 days. And I went to my banker, who was also a good friend and booster of the business, and I signed my part of the check, and the other part of the check, of course, was to the bank. And he took the check and signed it, and he said, "Do you want me to deposit this in your account?" And I looked at him, and I said, "Bruce, what are you saying?" I said, "Are you going to let me keep this money and use it to keep going in business?" And he said, "Well, yeah, I guess that's what I'm doing."
Mm-hmm.
And so the check was really for the money that I owed the bank for equipment and things like that, which were now all burned up. So Bruce Collison, my banker at U.S. Bank, gave me the privilege of staying in business. And there was one other major thing that happened. I know, the property with money. The property, of course, was pretty useless to me. But my real estate agent, Don Ossie, who has been with me now for 30 years, he called me in a few days, and he said, "Bob, if I could get you $165,000 for this property, would you let me keep the rest?" So, Don, I don't know what he was selling it for. But anyhow, I thought, my gosh, that's $300,000 between the insurance check and this and selling the property. And those are some of the factors that really made it possible to just simply stay in business. And then the same fella, Don, found us this wonderful 50,000-square-foot building that had just come vacant about 2 miles from where the mill was, and we moved into there.
Right.
And it took a while. I didn't lose a single person. I had about 20 people at the time of the fire, and of course, I have 320 now, so this thing is crazy, Donna, but we made it through it, okay?
Yes, you did, but Bob, one of the things that occurred, and I know we've just got a few minutes left here, with this, your story about working with a bank, the people that worked with you, that supported you, all of this, including your employees, which is just awesome. In 5 months, you were back into operation. Your business has been booming ever since, and you have had to move your facility because it just keeps growing and growing, and anyone can walk into a store. They can go to the website, bobsredmill.com. You can go in there. You can find all of the information about the products. Everything is wonderful on the site. But in the book, People Before Profit, one of the most powerful aspects about your story is that when you were 81 years old, you gave the company to your employees. And your statement was you felt it was the right thing to do. Your attitude always has been that you've put people before profit, just like Dave's wife inspiring you with a statement. He said, I can't give up on this. I've got to go because there are people that are depending on this. This is such a positive image. When you made that decision, Bob, what motivated you to choose that? Most people would say, well, I'll just sell the business and they'll get new owners. I mean, you turn it over to someone else. Why did you make that decision to give your multi-million dollar company to the employees that had worked for you all of those years?
Oh, I don't know why I'm any different than anybody else, and I think anyone could do what I did. Unfortunately, the educational system, I think the business system in the country, just keeps insisting on the bottom line, and so many companies have investors and several owners, and they have distant owners. In fact, I'd venture to say that probably 75% to 90% of the businesses in the country today have off-site ownership of some sort, so that the people that are running the business have really any control over what decisions are made. But all through a lot of things, Donna, things I've believed in the Bible, and things my father taught me and my family taught me, just a sense of moral integrity. But there's a curiosity to see, by doing things a little different, as long as it's done right, and as long as it's done in a way that serves other people, it's kind of an experiment to see what'll happen, but it's also a sense of responsibility that has come from my belief that we are our brother's keeper. We are responsible for one another, and I just have never let money, even though it's very important to paying your bills and keeping your people, dominate my life anymore. And so it's not too difficult to say no to certain things. I've had so many people want to buy this business. I've had, up even recently, I've had different large companies who tell me, you know, that they could take this thing and do this. And I've had so many opportunities to sell a business. And that created a pressure of sorts. How can I retain the ownership in the business and retire? And the ESOP, employee stock ownership, is a government sanction, an IRS sanction program. Actually, anyone who's interested in this that might be listening can go on a website, just punch in ESOP, and you can become a member and get information on it. And we spent about 9 years, Donna, researching to make sure. We went to a couple seminars on how to do it, and we kept getting closer and closer to settling on the ESOP as a way to exit the company and to make sure that it was sustained. And that's what we did in 1980, when I was 81. I'm sorry, what year would that be? I can't remember. But whatever, anyway.
We won't worry about that. We won't worry about that at all.
But anyhow, we signed this, and the value of the company is gone up considerably, and of course the stock of each one of the employees is increasing all the time. And the actual situation is this: that within about 9 years, the employees of this company will actually own the company, and I will not. So it's a gradual process. We've been successful enough, financially successful enough, to be able to continue to pay the ESOP in such a way so that we can transfer stock to the employees until they eventually will own the company. And I hope I'm alive, because it's going to be very interesting to see what they do, Donna.
I
hope
agree.
They don't make too many mistakes.
Well, Bob Moore, you are an inspiration. I want to thank you for your time. The book, People Before Profit, is something that's a publication that Ken Koopman put together that I think makes an incredible read. It's a real American story. And I'm so glad you were able to share this time with me. I wish you nothing but continued success. I think the story about your employees that's in this book, People Before Profit, the interaction of people supporting people is just phenomenal. And I recommend it highly. Bob Moore, thank you again for being my guest. For those of you listening, we're taking a break for just a moment. We'll be back. Donna Sebo here. My guest has been Bob Moore. He's the man that founded Bob Red Mill Natural Foods. Check it out. You will be glad you did. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome back. There are so many people in the world today that are creating what I call a negative impact. People will have attitudes about big corporations and big businesses. And I thought today it was a real privilege to be able to interview a gentleman who has walked the walk and has done exactly the opposite of so much that we see portrayed on the airwaves. Diane Sawyer had the opportunity of interviewing him in person. And this is a man that is just an incredible individual. And when you think about someone who at the age of 84 is still very active within his own company and the teaching and the training and education of his employees, that eventually they will, in 9 years, own the business that he had built so very, very carefully and diligently, but they're actively involved with it. I think there are so many of us that would like to be a part of something that would be there to be able to pass along to our kids, to be an example of good ethics in business. Well, the telephone lines are open if you wanted to give me a call, 888-627-6008. Tomorrow, my guest is going to be Dr. Michael Murray. We're going to be talking about what drug companies won't tell you and what doctors can't. And I'll tell you, it's quite an education for me. So Dr. Murray is going to be giving us more information. Eco-literate on Thursday, Lisa Bennett is going to be my guest. We're going to be finding out how teachers and kids, along with the teachers, are coming up with ideas for solutions to make this world a better place. Pendulum, Michael R. Drew is going to be my guest on Friday, and we're going to be talking about what people have done in the past affects what we end up doing not only in the present, but can also be a future predictor. So we'll be finding out more about that. And again, you can always call in, usually in the latter part of the program, but to have someone, an icon, like Mr. Bob Moore on the air, we spend extra time with him. It's a real privilege, and I'm so glad he was able to do that. So if you want to speak to me, give me a call at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. All I need is your first name or your initial. Dennis Waitley, a name many people are familiar with, said the reason most people never reach their goals is because they do not define them or even seriously consider them as believable or achievable. Winners can tell you where they are going, what they plan to do along the way, and who will be sharing the adventure with them. Well, I think that sometimes you don't honestly know. You can set a plan and you can put things into positioning, but life has a way sometimes of bringing in some twists and turns that you would never even imagine could happen to you. So my feeling is Dennis is right about some things, but I also feel that we need to be prepared for the unexpected. Life isn't a straight line, and I have found on so many occasions that the best laid plans sometimes do go wacky and from some of the most unexpected things. So that is my positioning, but I do feel having a plan, looking at things, being organized, and being open for opportunities, because sometimes you may start in one direction and find that a door opens for you, just like with Bob Moore, where he's on a walk. He thought he was going to follow another direction, and he sees a building, and he's on his way to success on so many levels because it touched a part of his heart and his mind, and he goes, this is for me. And that's what happens to us so many times, but we have to go through the process to get there. This is Donna Sebo. I know that we're out of time. I'm so delighted you were able to be with me today. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about what doctors can't tell you. Hope you can join me. And remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a magnificent day or evening, wherever you might be. We'll be back here, same time, same place, right here with the Donna Sebo Show. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.